You're going to embark on a six-session survey of the defense of the Christian faith. And you're to be commended for entering on this sort of thing because we're going to cover a great deal in the course of this week. All right. Let's begin then with the need for apologetics today. And we begin then with our contemporary situation, the problem of witness today. There are three words that characterize our time. Our age is secular, it is global, and it is pluralistic. Secular, global, and pluralistic. What do we mean by these terms? Well, global is easy enough. That, of course, alludes to that crazy Canadian Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan says, ours is a global society, a global village, if you will. What does he mean? He means that people today are bumping up against each other to a far greater extent than they have before. Communications have reached such a pitch that people can't get away from each other. This means that a diversity of viewpoint today is unavoidable. We no longer are living in an age where everybody believes the same thing, or approximately the same thing. Not in the least. We're in a situation where we are meeting people all the time who maintain positions different from our own. There is no way really to avoid this. You just can't get away from that kind of situation because communications are as powerful as they are at the present time. Turn on the TV, walk down the street, go to an airport, makes no difference where you are. You constantly come into contact with a diversity of viewpoint. Ours is a pluralistic age. Not only are you bumping against a wide variety of people, but these people maintain a wide variety of different beliefs. We don't have a homogeneous religious situation today. Today, you go into your airport and you find people in saffron gowns with their heads shaved going dingle, 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 and they represent a different kind of position from one that would have made any kind of sense at all to people in the 19th century. Today, a diversity of viewpoint is obvious, and because of the global nature of things, you can't get away from the diversity. The diversity presses in upon you. But the most characteristic element in our current society, the one word that describes it maybe better than any other, is the word secular. What do we mean by secular? We mean that ours is an age where the classical Christian values of our civilization are no longer dominant. C.S. Lewis talks about the great divide in Western civilization. A divide, he says, that is greater than any other single separation in all of our Western history. Greater than the Reformation. And this is a division between the time when people thought Christian and the time in which we live when people don't think Christian. He places this in the 19th century. I think it ought to be placed in the 18th century. I think if you want to find an event to pin this divide upon, it would certainly be the French Revolution. Prior to the French Revolution, people are thinking Christian, fundamentally. After the French Revolution, people less and less think Christian. One of the best evidences of this is the fact that prior to the French Revolution, if you were a non-Christian, you expressed yourself in Christian terminology, whether you liked it or not. Why? Because that was the only way to be understood. Illustration, Thomas Hobbes, who wrote The Leviathan. Hobbes was an atheist. But when you pick up Hobbes' Leviathan, this work of political theory written in the 17th century, it reads like the King James Bible. Not only in style, but also in the quotation of biblical verses and the like. There are people who have picked up Hobbes and they have thought Hobbes was a Christian. Actually, the man was an atheist. But he has to use Christian language in order to make sense to people in his day. Today, the situation is reversed. In order for Christians to make sense to non-Christians, they have to employ the terminology of secularism. One of the reasons why many Christians don't have any appreciable impact on their time is because they're still trying to talk a language and express themselves in a way that isn't any longer the dominant way of expression. We'll get into that in a little bit. Someone has described the three centuries of modern secularism as follows. In the 18th century, the Bible was killed. In the 19th century, God was killed. And in our century, the 20th century, man has been killed. What does this mean exactly? Well, in the 18th century, the beginning of modern secularism, a new position was developed called deism, D-E-I-S-M, deism. And the deists tried to hang on to Christian morality after getting rid of the Bible. This is bicentennial year, and though it may come as an appalling shock to you, most of the founding fathers were deists. They were not historic Christians. Thomas Paine, who wrote Common Sense, also wrote The Age of Reason. And this is a tract arguing for the establishment of deism rather than Christianity as a dominant religion. The whole second part of Thomas Paine's Age of Reason consists of nothing but an attempt to show errors and contradictions in the Bible. The entire second part is just alleged errors and contradictions in the Bible, which Paine believed were genuine. Says Paine in The Age of Reason, "You don't need the book of Scripture. All you need is the book of nature." What did he mean? He meant if you look at the walls of the universe, if you look around you, you look at human society, you look at life in general, you can find God, you can find morality and ethics, all that you need to live the good life. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, did a Bible of his own, which has come to be called the Jefferson Bible. What he did was literally to take a pair of shears and cut out everything miraculous related to Jesus or to the apostolic company, and he put only the moral teachings together, and that made a new Bible. And this has come to be called the Jefferson Bible. It was first printed, incidentally, at government expense by the U.S. Government Printing Office. Very interesting. Strange that Mrs. O'Hare didn't hear about this. But I don't think she would have opposed that too violently. Anyway, the founding fathers in general took the view that you don't need the Bible in order to establish the existence of God and morality. Along came the 19th century. People put up the blinds and opened the curtains and they looked out on nature again. But the world didn't look the same. No longer was the existence of God and clear morality evident when they looked out the window. Instead, what did they see? They saw the survival of the fittest. They saw the big animals eating the little animals. They didn't find a morality and a divine belief evident to them. Might made right when they observed nature. And toward the end of the 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche, the great German romantic philosopher, said, "God is dead." It was he who coined that phrase. God is dead. Now is the time for the Übermensch, the Superman, to take over. And the Superman doesn't have to follow ordinary values. He transvalues all values, said Nietzsche. In other words, he creates values himself. He creates a morality of his own. Nietzsche's view was that Jesus represented weakness because he felt that the poor would inherit the earth and that the weak ought to be supported. Instead, said Nietzsche, might will prevail and the strong man will impress his values on others. In other words, in the 19th century, God was eliminated, but people didn't think that that meant the end of mankind, hardly, because man, after all, could establish values for himself. And then in our century, along came such people as a disgusting little German house painter who regarded himself as an Übermensch, as a Superman. He read Nietzsche, he operated on the principle that might makes right, and he established value. And among the values that he established was that if you happened to be Jewish, you didn't have any value at all. You weren't a person before the law. And 6 million Jews went to destruction as a result of that kind of thing. In other words, the consequence of getting rid of God was the getting rid of man. And if you look at this more closely, you'll discover that the getting rid of God followed from the elimination of the Bible. You see, this is a sequence that isn't accidental. Where do we find the clearest picture of God? We find the clearest picture in the Bible. If, then, you get rid of the Bible, you have eliminated your clearest and most effective picture of God. The chances are, then, that God is going to disappear after you have gotten rid of Scripture. But once you've gotten rid of God, then who is to say what importance man has? Only men themselves. But then everything is up for grabs, because if you're stronger than the fellow next to you, then of course you can write your lecture notes on his cuff, whereas he cannot write his lecture notes on your cuff. The situation shifts then to a situation where the person who has more strength is able simply to impress his values on other people. And this results in an elimination of people who are not able to resist the whole operation. In our time, of course, man has been destroyed not only in a metaphorical or theological or philosophical sense, but in a very literal and real sense. There has been more destruction of human beings by their fellows in the 20th century than in all of recorded history. So, here we are in that kind of secular age. Now, the non-Christian today is aware of the fact that secularism has not given him what it was supposed to. Luther said that the history of the human race is the history of a drunken man reeling from one wall to another, knocking himself senseless against one wall and then going across and knocking himself senseless against the opposite wall. In the 19th century, people were still very confident that the elimination of the Bible and even the elimination of God wasn't going to make a great deal of difference. At the end of the 19th century, people very politely shook hands with God, thanked him for past services rendered, and decided to go on by themselves. Science and technology were going to take care of all problems, and soon a millennium would come about, but it would be a millennium established by human effort. The two world wars of our century have made it painfully clear that that sort of thing isn't going to happen automatically by any means. Fact of the matter is that all science and technology did was to give human beings techniques which they could use to destroy each other with greater efficiency than they had been able to do before. People, in other words, didn't become any less sinners. They didn't become any more capable of handling their own situation. They just became more efficient sinners, making it possible for them to create a maximal mess where previously they had created a mess on a more limited scale. In the middle of the 19th century, interestingly enough, the Great Exposition took place in London. This was a kind of technological orgy. It was an opportunity for people to present the great accomplishments of Western civilization. There is a marvelous novel which was published just a couple of years ago by J.G. Farrell called The Siege of Krishnapur. And this is a novel about the 19th century. In this novel, the leading characters are convinced of inevitable progress. Everything is coming up progress. Everything is coming out successfully. And then they experience the Indian Mutiny. And the Indian Mutiny does for them what the First and Second World Wars has done pretty generally for people. It convinced them that man really wasn't the kind of moral and clever individual that he was supposed to be. Anyway, at the Great Exposition, one of the exhibits was a train that could lay its own tracks. A train that could lay its own tracks and pick up the tracks again. And one of the leading characters in Farrell's novel can't understand, 12 years after the exposition, why these trains haven't become prevalent everywhere. It never seems to occur to him what the problem is with a train that lays its own track. You see, in order for a train to have some advantage over any other kind of vehicle, it must operate on a track which is apart from itself and firmly fixed to the ground. It's that that makes it possible for the train to go lickety-split. Any train that lays its own track, obviously, is very much like what we today think of as a tank. And obviously, such a vehicle has no greater stability than a non-train, because it cannot move rapidly under those conditions. It ends up having no advantages over something that isn't a train at all. But you see, that was exactly the fallacy of the 19th century. The 19th century thought that it could lay its own track, that the human race could operate apart from any sort of permanent foundation. And with the First and Second World Wars, that situation became very evident. And the pendulum swung from the wall of progress, of confidence in progress, all the way across to the wall of existential despair. No answers are possible. All one can do is to remain within the framework of his own experience and try to make some sense out of his own existence. And the only sense, really, is a sense that one imposes on the world, since the world doesn't offer any explanation of meaning by itself. In this kind of a situation, we find ourselves. We find ourselves in a secular age, 3 centuries old, a secular age that ran on inherited capital. First of all, taking the belief in God and the morality that had come from the Bible, trying to operate with that apart from the Bible. Eventually, the inherited capital of belief in God ran out. Then finally, morality and ethics and any kind of valuation of man ran out. And here we are in a situation where some people, a few, are hanging on to science and technology as the answer to everything, but in which most people consider that to be a chimerical dream. That isn't going to answer people's needs either. And so, of course, substitute answers appear in vast numbers. People on soapboxes everywhere saying, lo here, lo there. The answer is this, the answer is that. As communications have increased in effectiveness, these screaming prophets of diverse systems rise up on soapboxes everywhere you go, and you just can't get away from them. And people try one thing after another. Ogden Nash wrote the little poem, The Seven Spiritual Ages of Mrs. Marmaduke Moore, where poor Mrs. Marmaduke Moore jumps every 10 years from one sectarian piece of nonsense into another. In one verse, she leaps with a whoop into the land of the sweet Baha'i Baha'i. And this is a kind of symbol of our time, where people are desperately trying to find answers, and the problem isn't too few answers. I suppose the problem is too many. At least too many options are being presented. Under these circumstances, it becomes mandatory to be able to give an answer for the faith that is within you as a Christian. It is hardly sufficient under these conditions to try to shout louder than everybody else. Even if you've got a very loud voice and a very commanding presence, even if you've got charisma, merely the fact that you are shouting that loud is not necessarily going to carry the day because there are a lot of other people shouting. If you lived 100 years ago, how pleasant it would have been. Then the problem basically was to convince people that they ought to be consistent with what they already knew to be right. Everybody knew that Christianity was basically true, that the Bible ought to be followed. There were really only two kinds of people: those who knew that this was the case and true and were following it, more or less, at least sociologically they were doing so, and those who really knew it was true and were being inconsistent with it. And so in those days, an R.A. Torrey could produce a little handbook of Christian answers, and any objection that a person had could be looked up, and there was a Bible verse on the subject. And you simply quoted the Bible verse to the person. And of course he capitulated, eh? Or he went away unwilling to discuss the problem because he didn't have any counter to this. But you can't do that today. If you do that, he'll pull out his little manual, but it'll be keyed to the Bhagavad Gita, or it'll be keyed to the Book of Mormon, or to something else. In other words, there are all kinds of so-called supposed revelations which people use to answer problems today, and all kinds of different systems and approaches that are offered. Now, what has the church been doing in the face of this? Not very much, as a matter of fact. Not very much. We're going to talk about the church's response to this sort of thing in two areas. We're going to talk about the liberals and we're going to talk about the fundamentalists. I'm not going to define these terms carefully because I want to irritate the maximum number of people. I'll try to provide more precise definitions as we go along, but for the moment you will see what I'm talking about from my vague employing of this terminology. You will love what I have to say about the liberals, I'm sure. You will be appalled at what I have to say about the fundamentalists, but I think if you cogitate on this a little bit, you'll see that both of these critiques have something to them. The position of theological liberalism during the modern secular era can be summed up by the following little phrase: if you can't beat them, join them. If you can't beat them, join them. Hardly had Darwin's Origin of Species been published in 1859, but liberal English and American theologians started shouting that Christianity was evolutionary. A fellow by the name of Caird in England wrote a book entitled The Evolution of Religion, in which he said, "Why, you know, Christianity is basically evolutionary." Strange to say, no one had ever noticed this until Darwin's Origin of Species was published, but suddenly Christianity became evolutionary. It was a gradual religious growth that would carry mankind to higher and higher spiritual levels. Later on, when the pendulum swung from science and technology as the answer to everything and inevitable progress over to the extreme of existential despair, the theologians of the liberal stripe informed us that Christianity was basically existential. The essence of Christianity was not essence, but existence. Christianity was at heart a religion of personal dealing with despair and misery. It was not an answer to larger questions. When the racial revolution very properly took place in this country, suddenly the liberals informed us that Christianity at root was a theology of race. When revolution became the byword and everyone started screaming about the war in Vietnam, the liberals produced theologies of liberation. Anything that is presented in the modern secular era as the answer suddenly is transformed by the liberal into the meaning of Christianity. Now, what's the trouble with this? Well, liberalism becomes a kind of chameleon that sits upon the culture and changes changes color as the culture changes. And the chameleon does this so effectively that after a while you no longer see the chameleon. That is to say, you no longer see Christianity. Christianity is transformed into the secular position, whatever the secular position happens to be. It's as if a physician decided to treat a disease by becoming indistinguishable from the disease. The sad part about this is that the liberal loses track of any eternal message. In liberalism, Jesus is not the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus changes as the problems of the present change. The liberal thoroughly recognizes the nature of the current situation. He is a master in understanding the nature of the current situation. But having understood it, he has no absolute remedy. He has no permanent solution to bring to bear upon it. Instead, he tries to show the contemporary secular man that he can be as secular as the secularist, if not more so. And that Christianity is as secular, if not more so, than the secular situation. The result of this is not that people come trooping into the Christian church. The result is that people become utterly indifferent to Christianity because it doesn't offer anything that they didn't have contact with already. And the consequence of all of this has been that liberalism as a system and liberal churches as organizations have gotten weaker and weaker and weaker. Many large liberal churches survive today only because they prop each other up. There are ecumenical unions among liberal churches that keep them alive under conditions where they would have died. Liberal theological seminaries can hardly continue going. The Union Theological Seminary in New York has a steadily declining enrollment. If it continues to decline as it has in the last 20 years, it won't exist any longer in the next 20 years from now. Whereas in evangelical circles, the very reverse is taking place. This has produced a good deal of negative criticism of liberalism, and it's gotten to the point of sarcasm and parody. Some of you have read Peter DeVries' novel, The Mackerel Plaza. This is about a typical liberal clergyman, mackerel, called by his friends inevitably holy. Holy mackerel. And mackerel creates his own pulpit, builds it on four different fruit woods to symbolize the four gospels and their inability to harmonize. And he receives his great promotion to a central city church on the basis of a sermon, the theme of which is, it is the final proof of God's omnipotence that he need not exist in order to save us. It is the final proof of God's omnipotence that he need not exist in order to save us. Mackerel was a kind of pre-death of God theologian, you see, coming out in the years just before the death of God movement. A few years ago, in the declining enrollment, declining church attendance at the St. Paul's Cathedral in London, several of the canons parachuted off of the top of St. Paul's, quote, to bring the young people back to the church, unquote. They received Esquire's Dubious Achievement Award for that year, and the text of the award was, if God isn't dead, maybe he wishes he were. Okay? And this is just about the reaction of the secular culture to that kind of nonsense. On a less humorous level, but on a novelistic level nonetheless, is John Updike's magnificent novel, Rabbit Run. In that novel, Rabbit represents our contemporary American culture. Rabbit is the immature American of the 20th century whose success has been in high school as a basketball star running. See, running in a game, but he never knows where he's going. He's activistic. He is strong. He is young, but he never has gotten any real sense of direction or any values. And so when he graduates from high school, he doesn't know where he's going. And this is the story of a rabbit running with no meaning to his life. And the other central character is the Reverend Eccles, for ecclesiastical, or ecclesiology. And the Reverend Eccles is the liberal clergyman. And Eccles really feels for Rabbit. He empathizes with him. He wants to help him. He spends hours with Rabbit. He takes him golfing and he listens to his problems and the rest of it. And he doesn't do Rabbit one bit of good because he has no answers for any of it. He sees the problem. He doesn't know what to do with it because he hasn't got any word of God to present in the situation. Now, in contrast to this, we have the fundamentalists. You know, in the 19th century, end of the 19th century, liberalism and fundamentalism polarized, really. The liberals taking the approach, if you can't beat them, join them. And the fundamentalists taking the position, if you can't beat them, separate from them. If you can't beat them, separate from them. In the face of rising science and technology, evolutionary theory, Hegelian philosophy, and all kinds of opposition to the Christian faith, many Christians felt that there was just no fighting that sort of thing. They didn't know how to fight it. They didn't feel capable of fighting it. And so their approach was to shore up the situation, throw up the walls, and protect the believing community against this kind of thing. Thus, the phenomenon that we call sociological fundamentalism arose. In this phenomenon, you have an attempt to protect the believer against the world in which he finds himself, because all hope has been given up of dealing with the world in terms of its unbelief. What kind of walls are thrown up? Well, all kinds of walls. The blue laws constitute one of the most important walls thrown up by fundamentalism. No card playing, no attendance at the legitimate theater, etc., etc. What is the point of these laws? Well, they once had a significance because back in the frontier time, you know, that kind of activity was centered in the saloon. And in the saloon, along with card playing, was prostitution and drunkenness and genuine moral evils condemned by Scripture. And so the early preachers of revival on the frontier, the camp meeting preachers, said, "Come ye out and be separate. Get away from this kind of thing. Because this is immoral and you get into that sort of thing and you're done for." And they were right. All of this was interlocked in the saloon situation. And so they countered the saloon with the revival. And the revival was a different kind of emotional experience by which you could reorient your life. It was an emotional experience which centered, thank God, on Jesus Christ. But of course, as time went on, card playing and other activities of that kind became entirely separated from the saloon. Yet, the evangelical, the fundamentalist, feeling that it was necessary to protect his own against a ravenous culture of unbelief, retained these laws, and the laws have a function which is no longer really a moral function. The function is now to make sure that the believers are separated from the unbelievers. So walls of requirements are thrown up by which the non-Christian knows that this is a peculiar people. And it is. It is a peculiar people, but it's not exactly the peculiar people that the Bible was talking about. Sad to say, as a result of this kind of thing, the non-Christian feels that the way you become a Christian is to stop doing certain things or to start doing certain other things, and as a result of this, you could perhaps enter into this particular kind of social community. But that is as much works righteousness as what Luther and the Reformers thundered against. This is the dog returning to his vomit because it's putting up a threshold of works on the basis of which you enter into the kingdom. The only way into the kingdom happens to be by what Christ has already done on the cross, and that's by free grace. And there aren't any sociological requirements for entering the kingdom of God. There's only a theological requirement, if we can even call it that, and that's to stop thinking you can save yourself. Another barrier of this kind is a linguistic barrier. Sometime I'm going to find a student who is in linguistics, and this student is going to do, under my tutelage, a linguistics of fundamentalism. Because in any ghetto community, there is a special language employed within the community which clearly distinguishes the members of the community from those outside. There is a specialized vocabulary which is employed within the fundamentalist community which clearly identifies those inside and which also makes it clear to those outside that this is a special group. For example, the word fellowship. Only fundamentalists use the word fellowship as a verb. The word fellowship in the English language is a noun. You can have fellowship with someone, but fundamentalists fellowship with each other. Very interesting. Listen carefully and you will discover that there's only one category of people who fellowship with others. Those are fundamentalists. Other people have fellowship with. Also, the use of the peculiar adverb just in praying. Oh Lord, just help me, Lord, just to come to you, Lord, just to come closer to your cross, just let me, Lord, oh just let me, just. What is the function of this? Search me. It has no actual cognitive significance at all. What it does is to say, I'm different from the others. I'm not like them. And it gives the non-Christian, again, the impression that when he finally changes his style of speaking along that line, he will truly be accepted. You see, this is a ghetto kind of operation. It's similar to what you see when people come from a foreign country. They come over, and at first they're scared to death. They're scared of being eaten by the culture. And so they throw the walls up. They establish their own diet, or retain their own diet. They try to keep their own language. They want to keep the children away from the culture for fear they'll be destroyed through this. Eventually, you know, what occurs in a ghetto? The result is about third generation that people go raring out of the ghetto screaming for fresh air. In other words, the younger generation, about three generations subsequent to the arrival of the immigrants, is crazy mad to identify totally with the culture in order to get away from this extreme localization. And so often, by the third generation, all of the values that were genuinely there in the ghetto are lost. And don't we see this so often in fundamentalism, where the preacher's kid, the third generation child of the missionary is dumping the baby with the bathwater. He's losing the gospel of Christ along with throwing over all of these other things.